Corporation of Securities.
So still on supplementary evidence, paragraph 3.9. When you refer to the significant portion of landholdings affected by the repo, that they're also within the Wanaka Airport outer control boundary. Sorry, do you have a map that they're both shown on the same? Which two maps would I need to look at? Paragraph 311 about jurisdiction, where you seem to be saying that the territorial authorities will often manage activities that under the control of other authorities, and by that you mean the regional council? In terms of hazardous substances, though, aren't they both functions of both councils? Under 30 and 31?
That statement was more around the storage of hazardous substances, which is being managed in a situation with hazard at so the actual storage and so kind of that side of it. But yes, in terms of its location and things.
In the proposed rule 21.4x, the storage of hazardous substances, is that, I'm assuming that it's just farmland or whatever here that I'm, I don't know if they have agrochemicals stored there or something like that. Is there any limit that's envisaged, or just that there shouldn't be any there? Storage of hazardous substances, it means any that didn't consider a limit on a volume or anything like that?
Yes, I haven't got a limit here. What kind of limit is, what level is considered to be appropriate and safe? I guess it would need to be defined by the research aviation qualifications.
That's fine. In terms of the activity space, the definitions at the bottom there, golf course, is there a golf course within part of the area existing?
No.
Right. And then I just thought it was, what happens when the golf course runs a tournament and you have a whole lot of people there? Would that be?
The FAA guidance, I understand, doesn't consider golf courses to be usually a mass assembly of people, but
if somebody invites whoever the latest Tiger Woods is and they have a big tournament, I just wondered whether that should be therefore golf courses might not be appropriate?
Yes, in that context, golf courses may not be appropriate.
I guess the actual day-to-day use of a golf course would be different. And then the this plan here, which shows the, is there any plan that shows that in relation to this?
No,
no, there isn't. How hard is it to prepare one? It's just, it would be useful just to see where the overlay lines are and that relative to how it all sits on the planning maps.
I can get the drawing files
passed on
to
the
council.
Yeah, that would be helpful. The only, I think, limitation would be that we'd need it before. I'm looking at the chair here, so when we need it before.
Or
the right of reply.
Well, we'd send it no later than the end of next week.
End of next week, if that's possible.
Well, for the council to provide it to us, so you probably need to get it to the council. Okay. I think Mr. Barr, the idea was that the drawing file could be overlaid over the planning map so that at the right scale so that we can see the effect of things.
So then turning to your evidence in chief, your original paragraph 3.8, where you're referring to the the assessment criteria. That assessment criteria, how does that relate to which policy that does it relate to in terms of how it's been drafted? What one has it, is it linked back to? Which one does it link back to?
Yes.
Is it wider than those policies or not?
It could be wider than those ones. It depends on how the panel gets to with the decision of chapters 3 and 4 and 6, which provisions that also refer to conception.
So it could be wider at the moment, but that's something that we need to check. Yep. Four 9 and 4 10. The purpose statement. Does the purpose statement have status as being part of the plan or anything that you refer to when you're considering a resource consent?
Yes, it does. No, but it does provide, I think, clear guidance around, you know, what the purpose of the chapter is and what the council is trying to achieve. It's really the overarching tone of the chapter.
Over to form paragraph 418 with the objective hobby horse of mine, if you haven't worked it out yet, is about, it doesn't appear to be written as a environmental, it's not a statement. If I could recognise a goal of recognising the airport doesn't seem to achieve much in terms of addressing any resource management issue. Do you think there's any way that that could be rewritten as an actual objective?
Yes, I'm sure that can be rewritten as an objective.
Some of the questions I addressed Ms. Walt earlier, just about the any contact between QAC and the council as the requiring authority in terms of the submission, are you often?
Yeah, no, I'm not sure on that, with the level that I'm not involved with. Just to clarify though, I think Ms. Walt has probably in the legal submission paragraph 19 to 21, just how that whole situation operates is that the Queensland Council is the required authority. QAC manages the airport on behalf of the Queensland Council. I think there is a general position within council that they don't necessarily have the aviation expertise or knowledge to deal with airport matters. Must be required for it, but they do look quite strongly towards QAC guidance on resource consent, etc. So when somebody, for example, applies for a resource consent at one of the airports, they can do QAC written approval, and that provides a pretty strong steer to the council in terms of the required authority to deal with it. That provides them with a good steer and standard.
And 519. Just in terms of these possible planning provisions, so my understanding that you're suggesting a control activity status in there. How would that relate to requirement to get a written approval under 1761B of the requiring authority if you've got a controlled activity, whereas if the requiring authority refused consent or refused to give written approval, but the council can't decline a controlled activity, how would that work?
That situation already can arise. If I think, for example, the optical limitation service, which is the one that defines the height limit for different buildings, you can be a permitted activity and you might want to construct a permitted building somewhere, even plant a tree, and if it penetrates the optical limitation service, you would still be required to get the required authority's approval. And
So if it was, so does that mean that there's no difference or conflict?
Yeah, they're separate. They're treated separately.
Right.
So yes, you could have a controlled consent.
So you
could consent, but you couldn't have a consent.
So that. So you could have a control, the council would have to grant the resource consent, but you'd never been able to give effect to it because of 176.
In practice, ordinarily, as an applicant, you'd probably go to the requiring authority first, and then take your consent application to the council.
Mm.
It's probably worth noting about that all of Monaco Airport is owned by QLBC.
If the reaper was to come in, where would that just be shown in the diagram in the text of the plan, or would it also be shown on the floating maps as well?
I think it should be on the floating map.
Does it need a special schedule or anything related to the provisions within the text within the plan or a reference?
Question in relation to your main statement of evidence. From section 3, you've got a discussion around the functional, technical, and operational and safety requirements for infrastructure to be located within outstanding infection and impacts, and you've got a discussion there. Now, 3.1.3. He says provisions of the proposed district plan relating to these areas currently place excessive weight on avoiding, remedying, or mitigating adverse effects of development, even where there are regionally and or nationally significant benefits inherent in enabling an activity that on balance outweigh the adverse effects. Are you suggesting there that the infrastructure that you're talking about in this context becomes more important than the matters of national importance out of section 6 of the Act, is that?
No, this particular summary point is just a summary from my original brief of evidence related to chapter 3, 4, 10, 6.
Yes.
And in that brief of evidence, I noted that the way that the provisions are currently drafted there is a requirement to essentially avoid all adverse effects on, for example, the natural features of the natural landscape. Now, the example that I use for that is the runway safety area. There was a reclamation activity back in 2018, and that was required to ensure that Queenstown Airport had a safety area that was sufficient to meet civil aviation requirements, The Shotover River is an outstanding natural landscape, so if there's no recognition that there may be some, or we have very limited circumstances where there is a need to put such infrastructure location in this area, if there's no recognition of that, then these infrastructure providers, despite there being obvious significant benefits to Queenstown, for example, to the airport, that kind of activity would no longer be able to occur. The evidence basis for that still is very, very high.
Thank you. I didn't sit on the strategic campaign for that.
So I'm not suggesting that infrastructure should be like go anywhere and everywhere. We'll just be very limited circumstances.
Which is good to clarify the example of the thousand years for research. If QIC hadn't been able to build that, it would have lost all its international sites. Would have needed to build in the runway in order to retain its international sites. So obviously that would have had very significant consequences for the district, especially economic well-being.
Thank you.
Can I ask a related one? Just that, how does the RIFA work at the Frankston Arm end of the airport where it's seems to me to be fairly developed. I think there might even be a school there, which I'm sure is not something.
There is not a
RIFA
at Frankston Arm. There is a RIFA at the Wanaka Airport has the benefit of not having the development around it. So there is a school there, which I can find out. I'm pretty sure it has to do with the school.
So is any of not having a map will know that does the designation extend over beyond the runway or does it end at the sort of the boundary fence there where
the designation ends? There is a building line restriction on being shot over.
That's the other end?
That's the other end. I believe that I'm not sure how that original building line extension came to be in the operative plan, but it does have the added benefit of potentially restricting building on the shot over.
Not totally related, I assume the building line restriction is still there under the proposed plan. Okay. Thank you.
Just a couple of questions. In paragraph 4.5, talking about an area excluding activity sensitive, altering an objective. Are you intending that that applies to all new activities or all activities, including those that are existing?
Exclusions for existing
Okay. The only other question I had is respect of Queenstown Airport. Which parts of the rural zone are affected by the operations of Queenstown Airport? Well, it probably is the out of control boundary, because it's just in paragraph 4.21 you refer to the Michael's Park, the Queenstown Park, imposing. And you say here, Queenstown Airport has sought to include PCP final zones that is the final route to reflect. I'm just wanting to get my handle on which bits of the rural zone are affected by the airport. And I don't think we need to worry unduly about Shotover River or the Kararau River or the bay itself. Could you just, if we go to map 31, if you could just point out to me which areas
31A. Okay, so you'll have everything that's within the out of control boundary, which is your green line.
Mm-hmm.
So that will be affected by aircraft noise. Then you have the optical notation services, which aren't shown on this map, they're shown on photos 1, 2, photos 1 and 2, which is also a different thing. Taking the page on this, but if you have your map booklet.
Yes, it's the third to last page.
Yes. So there are extensive areas there that are located within the rural zone.
Area between Hanson Road and the new roundabout on the north side of the state highway is probably the only bit of rural land directly affected where there's any area of contention. Would that be a fair statement? The other land is ONL or ONF or has other restrictions on it.
You might hear about that at the plan changes
hearing. Well, that's another issue.
Yeah. And the land that's currently to our VC designation, which is the corner to the north of the airport, down from the airport and state highway, so that area is currently rural zone as well.
Yes. That's the
event
here.
Yes.
Yeah.
But yes, you're right, so the rest of the area is coming out.
Okay. Thank you.
I just have one follow-up. In terms of the bespoke planning scenarios, sort of airport, from a planning perspective, I think there are three. Which is the best one that should be applied?
So I've been a bit of time looking at this because I have the submission I refer to an overlay, which is like a 50 condition that overlaps or overlaps in common. Even if it isn't used anywhere else, so I overlay, Tim, the word overlay seems to be used in the same context as a cell phone. So I think that it's just semantic. I couldn't find any same difference between them. Perhaps council might be able to clarify that. So I didn't have a preference in terms of overlay or cell phone. It usually achieves the same outcome. The mixed-use zone, I think, would be efficient from its administration perspective, but it would potentially require a bit more work, and some of that work council would probably like, I suspect, would need to do a variation to achieve some of that. But that would become a legal matter in terms of scope. The provision of the computer to do it, mixed-use zone would need to be very carefully drafted to ensure that they were within the scope of QAC permission.
With or without doing a variation?
Verify.
Yep.
Legal measure. We would need a variation to change from scope of QAC permission, and in my QAC permission doesn't provide quite a full scope. As I've said in my legal submissions, you don't need to look at, I suppose, the overall what is QAC permission trying to achieve. It's trying to achieve a framework for the airport, which appropriately provides for the airport, whether that's an overlay or a sub-zone or a special zone for the airport or two. So I don't think it matters too much what the name. But if you were to go down the airport and use that route, you would need to, to a variation, the rules that apply, the objective policy that apply to Queen's to Wanaka Airport would need to be drawn from what the QAC permissions are, so new provisions that keep something similar that QAC has brought. And then provisions which are similar to the rural zone provisions, which otherwise apply to the airport or apply to the airport, with those new provisions to matters other than what those new provisions are true. So you're pulling across some of the rural provisions into the Wanaka airport chapter, and if you can do that, then you're within scope.
Yeah.
If you need to do something a bit more than that, then you need to do a variation. So you only need to go down the variation route when you start going out outside the QAC permission. And you just can't give you a definitive answer on that until the work's done, as to whether, in fact, we can work with what's in QAC permission to pull together a component part of the airport mixed use zone, which is Wanaka. We may be able to do it, but we won't until we start working on it. And we are happy to work with the council to do that, if it's certainly possible. Because if it turns out a variation is required, you can get it out from the airport and we need to tinker with the provisions a bit more than what QAC permission needs us to do. There is a time frame there to notify the variation, have the submission period run, and have that be ready for hearing at the time the Queensland Airport Mixed Use Zone chapter is heard, if that's going to be. So I've done the numbers and it can work from that time frame. There's ample time to do it, in fact. And at that point, then any submissions on first submissions on rural zone and QAC submission, chapter 21 would merge and be deemed submissions on the
going back to you, Mr. Salva, so my question was more about, give us three examples and that, so which one from a planning perspective do you think would work?
I'm happy with both, but I don't think that there are pros and cons each. I don't think there's one that would outweighing the other, which is in the rural zone.
Which one of those fits best within the, if any, planned reasons, fits best within the current structure of the plan to maintain consistency in the plan in terms of how that's been set out?
As
they're
currently drafted,
the
provisions fit within the rural zone, but
that's
about it. Clearly noted that the airport isn't really a rural activity. So I think in a mixed use zone, in terms of how it fits with the plan, mixed use zone would probably be featured from an administrative perspective. So people can pick up the plan and go, oh, I don't want to go, this is where I need to go.
Thank you. That's all. That's it.
Thank you. We're looking for additional information if you want to find that.
I noticed Mr. Ray looking for the what.
Yes.
If he has to get away, we'd be happy to deal with him first and then okay. Make all submissions subsequently if that suits you.
Yeah, about three pages of my submission deal with the detail of Skydive's proposed will, which I think Mr. Ray would say would be of most interest to me and what you on. So I thought I just might start on those submissions and introduce them today and then hand them over to you for questions. So I'd like to turn to page 6 of my legal submission, and further way down is heading in single airport, Skydive control for restricted discretionary role. First I talk about Reed Skydive, and I understand that this case was provided to you by Ms. Winchester with the opening legal submission, so I haven't heard it along with it, but I did see a reference to it.
I think that's it.
But anyway, if we can't locate it, I can certainly apply it to you.
Yes,
very nice. Skydive does not seek to relitigate the Environment Court's decision and read Skydive. It accepts that it's skydiving activity and any expansion of it creates adverse effects on the environment, particularly its nearest neighbours. In this regard, the Environment Court is particularly focused on the golf course, especially holes 2, 3 and 5, got 14 of the preserved proposed lodge, walking and cycling tracks and to a lesser degree the playing field and playground. Rather, Skydive seeks a rule that enables its activity and possible growth while managing effects. And I'll just put a footnote there to Mr. Brown's objective, and I'll cover that more fully when I get on to my other legal submissions.
I take it from that comment that I guess You're one of the numerous.
Yes, I'm one of Mr. Brown's, well, my clients, one of Mr. Brown's clients, yes. So I understand you only want to hear from the experts once, so who's going to?
Yes, so that's right.
The decision in Reed Skydive was, of course, based on a specific application before the court, the assessment of effects of that particular application, and the application of the policy framework in the Office of District Plan. The decision doesn't have the effect of a complete veto with respect to any future proposed increase or expansion of skydiving activity from its current location. And on the next page, I've just quoted a paragraph from the concluding comments of the first judgment. And perhaps the last couple of sentences are pertinent. The court said it may be that if the skydiving application had gone to the class hearing, some of the issues now raised could have been explored more thoroughly. The applicant chose to go that possibility, and we have inadequate evidence to satisfy us as to alternative operating conditions. So my submission is that that clearly leaves the door open for Skylight to come back at some future point in time with a revised application to try again. So that's relevant to that quote there. In the next heading elements of the rule, I'll just set out the proposed control activity rule and the restricted discretionary rule. These were set out in the memorandum that was filed where my Southern Tourism and Skydive withdrew each other's cross submissions and amended their release of thought. Essentially, that they have the same elements, just status is different. Picking up on the effects that require management from re-skydive, the following controls are proposed such that the effects are either avoided, remedied or mitigated to an acceptable degree. We've got flight paths, those were mentioned in those paragraphs in the decision and generally in other paragraphs as well. The court examines the effects of those people located beneath the flight path, observing that noise and the level of annoyance received at those locations depends on flight paths. Section 16 duty was mentioned in the decision, the court noting various actions or measures that could be taken to comply with the duty. Use of the airstrip is an essential element of the commercial recreation activity, and the court touched on that in those paragraphs of the decision. In terms of the use of the airstrip as being part and parcel in that case of the commercial recreation activity. There's mention of holding position of aircraft in relation to ice and noise, a mitigation measure, and there was mention of the 55 LDN noise limit, which the experts agreed with the criterion for controlling noise on residential and village accommodation activities. Mr. Day's evidence is that during the course of preparing an application, the analysis by the acoustic engineer might show a conditional consent that will restrict the number of flights per day for practical compliance purposes, but that this is dependent on the type of aircraft used and the type of threshold of the aircraft combination. The condition would be to the effect that whatever restrictions are placed in the condition, be it flight numbers, paths, or type of aircraft, for example, must be compliant with Rule 36, 5, 13, and 14. So those are my legal submissions around Skydive proposed rule. I can answer the questions you have about this now, or
I'd be more efficient if we dealt with Mr. Day and if they arose and you need to answer them in the course of that. So we'll probably be best way to deal with that. Now, does Mr. Day have a summary in the room, or are you just going to?
I hadn't read the summary with such a short brief of evidence, but that's
fine.
Firstly, thank you for your consideration in terms of the time. I'm in the hot tub tomorrow morning in front of the Christchurch Independent Hearings Panel, and I'm the only one I get out at 3:50.
You don't have like flight flights.
No, I have to. Thank you.
Commissioner Sinclair, do you have any questions at this
I guess while you're thinking of questions, I might just take up your opportunity to short summary. Really, what I'm saying is that I, as a noise person, I am practicing the resource management field. I think that rules based on effects, i.e. noise limits, are better than rules based on numbers of aircraft movements that become locked in place. And the previous Skydive was an example of that, where they were given consent many years ago for a certain number of flights a day. It was a very noisy aircraft, and later on they changed over to quieter aircraft and were still restricted to the same number. And so the application was all about trying to readjust that and draw on the noise basis. Unfortunately, due to the effects on the golf course, the application wasn't successful at that time. But that's the real thrust, is that it should be a noise-based, effects-based control rather than physical numbers that have got some historic generation. Short summary.
So my question is, because I appear to have been misinformed. In terms of the rules, my understanding is for these informal airports, there's a limit on the number of flights and distance from road boundaries and a notional boundary on houses. I'm trying to look at how does this relate to that? You're saying that it should be. Is it we're dropping that altogether?
No, I suppose that would stay as a permitted activity rule, is my understanding. And then there'd be either a controlled activity or a strict discretionary activity rule that would allow an application for something that didn't either quite meet those or was different in other aspects. But as of right, you could go ahead with that if you meet those numbers, so that's fine. And I've said in my evidence it's quite a conservative basis, which is the way permitted activity rules are sometimes written. Yes. A set of very conservative noises. Yes. If you can meet that, you can meet it. If you want to do something else that's moderate, then you've got to come up and you do.
And on that first page, you and Dr. Charles are then on the same page?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so this would only apply to whatever the next activity, space, general, Everest, and I take it that Queenstown Skydive, which is the airport out by, or airfield out by Jack's Point, that one,
yes.
They have current consents. They wouldn't meet the permitted activity standard if they were going to do other?
They've got a consent, but yes. This was the one I was referring to, as a fixed number of rovers per day, which is part of their original consent.
Right. And so under this provision, they would be, in theory, they would just apply if they wanted to, under whatever the smooth rule happened to be.
But that's probably a better question, better directed in more detail.
Right, yeah. And then, how does the, because we're here doing the rural part, how does it link to Section 36 about the, Chapter 36, or Rules in 36, which are related to noise?
I'm not going to understand, it links to Chapter 36. As you go over three flights a week, or it might be three a day, I think now, these are the recommended, then you potentially fall into the controlled activity or restricted discretionary activity rule. But to apply under that rule, you also have to comply with the noise limits that are in Chapter 36 of the plan. So that's the link between those rules, which with respect to fixed wing aircraft require 55 DEA at all times.
The only question I've got today is, are there circumstances where going beyond the permitted activity level, there may be a point at which there's an inappropriate number, that there may be a level where the council has to say no, that's too much?
I'm just trying to think of a situation where that might arise, but basically with this requirement of Rule 365, which is the meeting that Moisner was probably just mentioned, means that there will be a reasonable noise level at a residential location, and you might tie that in then to a certain number of aircraft to fly to meet that noise level of 55 dB at that residential. And the only situation would be if there's some other activity adjacent, like in the Jack's Point case, there was a golf course also under the flight path, and it was primarily that that the judge had difficulty with. So it was meeting the, there was no real difficulty with the residential noise levels, but it was the noise levels on the golf course that caused the problem.
Would that be a reason to decline or to reduce the numbers?
I'm just trying to get a handle as to whether the council would need the discretion to decline an application that was meeting the noise limits.
Yes, I think you need to keep the numbers and the noise limits separate, and it would look at what the appropriate numbers were. It might take advice on what's an appropriate noise limit for. Well, firstly, is the 6805 55 dB residential appropriate in this case? And then I hear that. And then if there was something different adjacent to it, maybe a convention centre or something, I guess it's all the zones, place centre or whatever, that maybe in that case that it needs to be lower than 55 for residential, for a place centre, or it could be higher than that for a recreation zone, and they could look at those issues, make a decision on the noise levels, and then the experts can then tell them that this particular aircraft, how you can warrant compliance is you're allowed these numbers and that will achieve that noise level.
I think that answers my question.
Yeah,
I'm not sure. Did the court, when it, in regard to the golf course, did it, in terms of the noise levels, was that more important for, I don't know, driving or putting or?
It didn't get into that level of detail, right. But basically Philip Tartarini came along, gave the evidence and thought it was an unreasonable level of noise. I gave evidence as a golfer and an acoustician having played the course six times, and my experience of the level of impact. But basically you stop whatever you're doing, whether it's putting or driving, for 20 seconds, because it's such an unusual event anyway, having an aircraft that's only about 50 metres away from you as it's coming over. That's very loud, but it's gone in 20 seconds, you stop and you move on. It only happens on three holes. Thank you very much again for your consideration of this issue.
Okay, well, I'll just go back to my legal submission and I'll start at the introduction. Scott, I've got submissions to the team. First of all, submission to the amendments we made to the zone purpose, objectives and policies of the rural zone to provide greater recognition and encouragement to commercial and recreational tourism activities. A full amendment to the policies related to the international airport. The rule we've just been talking about, initially thought permitted activity rule for informal airports should be based on flight numbers combined with noise rules rather than any maximum. And it's admitted that the standards for the number of persons participating in a commercial recreation activity should be increased from 10 to 28. Summarising the relief and the amendments to that, the amendment sought by Skyline to the higher order provision to set out Mr Brown's evidence, specifically amendments there to the zone standards and a new objective 21, which reference to land associated policies. Amendments relating to informal airports. I've set out there the amendment that Skydive has sought in its submission to delete the last part of the policy and insert in accordance with Civil Aviation Act requirements. And in the submission, it reasons that the operation and management of airports within the CAA are not controlled by territorial authority, which is not strictly E13. It's accepted that the territorial authority does have one of the functions of management of the debt, the use plan, and the establishment of objective policies and roles. So it's an amendment to release of thought to leave the policy as notified and checked, but to include its change as added in as and in accordance with the regulation. The Committed Activity Rule for Informal Airports Guideline has amended the release and that as a result of discussions with another submitter, it no longer pursues the Committed Activity Rule and set out in the memorandum amending the release or to the Control Activity Rule or an alternative discretionary rule. with respect to numbers of persons participating in commercial recreation activities, rather than pursuing the change in the number of participants in the rules, guidelines seek to adopt similar rule change that promoted by Tourism with respect to heli skiing, and the release seems to be as follows, and skydiving being added to that rule. I'm not sure if all of the Commission have read the memorandum that was filed back in April, but I do sort of go back to it. Totally Tourism has lodged a submission to the plan supporting the notified standards for informal airports. In particular, the Commission Activity Rule, which is qualified by the frequency of flights, and that's the rule we've just been talking about. In response to Skydive's submission, seeking a different approach to that Commission Activity Rule, Totally Tourism lodged a further submission opposing the release of qualified Skydive, primarily for reasons of uncertainty or cost of budget compliance. A rule specifying a maximum number of flights per day a week is more certain and easy to demonstrate compliance with than producing evidence from an acoustic expert that noise limits will be or not, or haven't been exceeded. That's in regard specifically to the Commission Activity Rule, and Skydive sets that rationale. In advance of this hearing, Skydive, the TTL entered into discussions culminating in both parties agreeing to withdraw their further submissions to each other's original submissions, and Skydive amending the release forced its primary submission so that regulation of flight numbers based on compliance with noise standards will be required to go through a regular consensus process. The rules have been promoted by two are quite different. Since the dense evidence for DDL supports the Commission Activity Rule, which without more is based on a maximum daily flight number, whereas Skydive promotes control or alternatively restricted discretionary activity rule based on its earlier compliance with noise levels. It submitted the release sought by Skydive within the scope continuum, being somewhere between the proposed provision that's notified and Skydive's submission. With respect to the rule changes proposed, the release now sought a narrow scope of the rules and moves towards a less liberal regime, closer to the planned position that's notified. Now, I've said there, the test is not whether the release has been expressly sought in the submission, but whether the release sought would go beyond what's fairly and reasonably raised in the position. And just on that point, the objective and policy changes that are supported by Skydive, while not exactly as per the submission, likewise fairly and reasonably within the scope of their submission, seeking the greater recognition in the policy framework of recreation and tourism activities. Just the amended release in a bit more detail, talking about the higher order provisions, guidance submission on these provisions as a continuation of the submissions and evidence presented to the strategic directions chapter that seeks greater recognition of tourism, including commercial recreation activities and the SAD policy framework. I've read the lead submission from Council for Queenstown Park, and just incidentally, Queenstown Park are one of the 12 submissions for whom Mr. Brown has prepared evidence, and without wanting to unnecessarily lengthen my submission by repeating names covered by others, Skydive agrees with and supports TTL submissions concerning the rural general size policy framework to the effect that tourist activities are essential to Queenstown's economy and should be provided for in the rural, and that non-farming activities should be added to farming activities. And you'll hear more on those submissions from Mr. Young, who's the legal representative of the Queen's Charter, that those submissions have been pre-filed with the Council. Skydive submits that Mr. Brown's amended objective and policy provides the necessary platform, policy foundation, if you like, for the rules that sit under each of which are being promoted by Skydive. And I might just quickly turn to those. You might not have them before you, but Mr. Brown's policy, objective rather, is a range of activities that rely on or benefit from a rural location are enabled while adversely affecting ecological values, landscape values and rural character and community values are managed. So that's the objective. The policy states to provide for the establishment of non-farming activities, including commercial, recreational, rural living and diversification of farming activities, only where these are avoided, limited or mitigated as they respect ecological values, landscape values or broader character and energy values. So they are primarily the two higher order divisions, if you like, that Mr. Brown proposed in his evidence, in which I say provide the policy framework for guidelines.
Can you just remind me which page in this
paragraph? Page 9 of Mr. Brown's evidence, paragraph 2, page 13, the next part of the submission is not already read to you, but it might assist if I just go through on page 7, the elements of the rule. These were set out in the referendum that was lodged. Whether it's the controlled activity rule, the restricted discretionary rule, it sits between permitted and discretionary.
I understand what those acronyms mean now.
I was trying to use shorthand, it sort of appears in other places. The rule is triggered if there are more than, I've used the notified provisions, which is 3 flights per week, but I now understand it's maybe 2 per day, that's a recommendation, but it's triggered if the permitted activity flight numbers are exceeded. And,
can we just make a note there that the 3 vehicles permitted is exceeded? Is the intention.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Whatever.
And it also has to comply with part B of the rule. So the qualification there is that whatever the flight number is proposed, they can't exceed the noise limits in rule 36.514, and that was the crossover limit on the noise chapter of the plan. The use of the land for the takeoff and landing of aircraft must be part of a commercial recreation activity taking place on the same site upon which the informal test is situated. Just a note that I've made here, the standard in relation to the 500 metre separation distance isn't proposed to apply this rule because we're going through a requirement to demonstrate compliance with the noise rules.
And the rule about 500 metres, that's for both road end and
distance from you.
Right, yeah, for both, yeah.
Just with number 2, must be part of the commercial recreation activity, is that consistent was seeking the skydiving to be identified separately from commercial recreation activities in the activity list? Well, and I presume taking tourism, seeking heli skiing to be separate as well.
Separate in the context of not of being exempt from the people numbers component. So. Yeah. It still will be a commercial recreation.
Indicated that it was coming to determination is just dealing with the effect of the noise, that there might be a limit on the number of flights and the nature of the aircraft. Shouldn't those matters be included in the matters of control or discretion?
my understanding is that those factors go into whether the number of flights proposed will comply with the noise standards. So,
but yes, but that was, I think that's the point the court got called on, wasn't it? If the applicant says we can achieve the noise standards with 12 flights per day with aircraft X, and the decision makers have heard the evidence, decide that in fact the acceptable level is actually 10 flights per day, then this doesn't provide the discretion to make that change. They have to refuse consent. And if it's controlled activity, it's stuck between a rock and a hard place.
My understanding is that putting to one side compliance with that noise limit, the court's other concern in the life around the reasoning of the text in terms of what more to do with flight paths. So if you can craft your application so that your flight paths are always those high nuisance life areas, then I think that's quite
That may be the case for Scarborough and Queenstown, but this is a rule that will apply throughout the district, and there may be other instances where that's not the solution. Do you think that's possible? Especially with helicopter flights. They are going to be more problematic if they fall there for it. Issue, then I would have thought that's twin planes. There's probably still scope within submissions that we consider. Mr. Brown might be able to answer that when we see him on Friday. I just raise it because of all the issues I've dealt with the airports. You end up balancing the noise against the number of aircraft.
I guess in some respects that's why the requirements to have the Commercial Recreation Act to be taken place on the same side as the airstrip, again, sort of narrow down potential types of activities that might take advantage of this rule.
But you want to be divorced from the numbers, so there's an unlimited numbers of Commercial Recreation Act. Unlimited number of people. That's not a commercial activity limited to 10 persons.
No.
And there are instances I know of heli schemes where they don't necessarily lead from airports, they'll meet somewhere and then fly up into the mountains from there. And that would then immediately create an issue.
Yes.
And I'm sure the one that presently does that in the Matokitoki Valley is not going to be an issue.
No.
I can imagine in the Matokitoki Basin, if someone was to start having that, it could become an issue quite quickly. I'm just thinking that Mr. Brown might go up front of mind to that, and Ms. Hutton's busy making notes to pass on.
The number 28, while you're not seeking any more, as I understand it, where's the number 28 come from?
It was the capacity of the coach.
Right, not the size of the helicopter.
No.
The plane.
Yes.
But the bus. No.
Yes. I mean, just on that front in terms of helicopter equipped craft, SkyDive's submission is lodged, referred to compliance with the rule about fixed wing aircraft rather than helicopters. So it wasn't necessarily envisioning that this rule would apply to helicopters as opposed to fixed wing. So
I understand that from your client's point of view, but the rule is going to will apply to that. Unless it's specifically stated it's purely for fixed wings.
Well, that the position that was lodged didn't only specifically refer to standard or fixed wing aircraft, not the rule that provides for helicopter noise. So, because there are helicopter noise is 15
CBA,
whereas the fixed wing is quite the bar at 55. So, whether that would prevent a jurisdictional bar to having this rule applied to helicopters as well as fixed. At paragraph 22, the rule promoted by Sky Owner's Commission originally applied to any informant report irrespective of its use. Consistent with its submission that the planning provisions recognise and provide for tourism and commercial recreation activities, Sky Owner proposed its rules relate major airports as part of a commercial recreation activity taking place on the same site as an informal airport. Paragraph 24, later I'll set out the definition of commercial recreation activity from the proposed plan. Just to note that here we have obviously the transportation of clients participating in that recreational activity. Skydiving, by its nature, is a recreational activity that has as its sixth component and jump down an aircraft, use the aircraft to transport clients, and some of these components of the activity. It actually begins and terminates on the same site. That's not the old formal airports that contain the Bastion Skydive rule. And I say this is appropriate in the context of both policy frameworks for the rule and the hour of the number of activities that the Bastion rule. Finally, moving on to the number of tests, for much the same reasons we set out the evidence submitted again, the CDL Skydive seeks that Skydive will be added to Rule 21.16. Summary, skydiving falls within the definition of casual recreation activity. Now, a typical day, skydiving involves one or two machines taking up to 19 passengers that the client can guide to the trip. There are numerous trips or flights that the client can be guided to today. If we've reached the proposed risk of 10 people and trigger a discretionary activity consent. Fixed wing aircraft used to provide the essential transportation for the skydiving activity lead to the greatest effect on the environment by virtue of noise they emit rather than necessarily the number of persons partaking in the
Are you adjourned until 3:35?